Yeah, shall we? It's become a bit like a bro fist moment, hasn't it? Okay. 3, 2, 1.
Ciao!
Ciao!
I think I went early.
Abandon the podcast.
Right then, listeners. We've all survived the storms of Abigail and Bob and Rita and whatever the next one's going to be called, which means that we're here to give you the Linux Voice Podcast Series 3, Episode 20. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in today's fun-packed audio emission, we've got a... I'm just going to mix it up. I'm not going to tell you what order things are going to be. We've got an Og box. We've got a Voice of the Masses. We've got news. We've got a halfway reminder. Have we got to Speak Your Reins?
We have a Vocalise Your Neurons. I have no idea what you're talking
excellent.
About. Speak Your Brains.
And I forget. I'm old. And we've got that other thing. Discoveries.
Finds.
Or finds, either or. If you like that, if you like the sound of this, but just more better, we do a magazine, which is also called Linux Voice, in a either a tragic lack of imagination or a stroke of branding synergy. The magazine is the same name as the podcast. And you can get us at Barnes & Noble in the United States. You can get us at WH Smith and Tesco's and Asda. And some other places in the United Kingdom, and Eason's in Ireland, and I don't know where. Brazil, and Hong Kong.
Yeah, and of course online on our shop, shop.linuxvoice.com.
That's the one, Mike. That's the one. And those PDFs, do they have any DRM in them? Because I don't really like DRM.
Don't say that dreadful word, DRM. That's the digital restrictions management. None of that with us.
Okay, so you buy a digital subscription to Linux Voice. You can read it anywhere on whatever device you want, and that's important.
Including in EPUB format, if you'd rather a reflow rather than a PDF.
Incredible stuff. I know you do a lot of work on the EPUB versions, don't you, Ben?
As does Graham.
As does Graham. Mike and I just don't.
So issue 22 is out today. We've got a competition from our friends at Pine Moroni have sent us loads of cool gadgets. Lots of Raspberry Pi boards. They're like mini arcade cabinets. They've not actually sent us them. they've offered us a load to give away. So there's a really cool competition in there. I've already had loads of entries. Some people taking it very, very seriously.
If not enough people enter, do we get to keep the stuff?
I think
too
many. Don't enter. Don't enter.
Well, yeah. Basically, you've got to find lots of penguins in the magazine. And we said find 10, but somebody's found 34.
That's one every 3 pages. How many penguins are in there?
I don't know. There were 10.
Oh, no.
Is this like if you take the third letter of every fourth word, it spells out penguin?
Maybe there's some. Maybe there's a load of white noise in the magazine somewhere and somebody just sees penguins. I haven't actually thought about the end of the competition and how we fairly, you know, draw out the results randomly for a hat, but it'd be good to do it in the podcast or live or something.
Yes, right. You're right.
After your introduction, Andrew, I now have no idea what's going on.
It's news time!
It's news, right. Oh. Right, let's have a look at the sheet of news. First up, on our Linux Voice newspaper, the investigatory... I have so much difficulty saying that word. Investigatory powers bill. The IP bill.
That's part of their genius plan, so that nobody opposes it.
You sound like a fool whenever you try and say it. The investigative bill. This is a snooper's charter. Let's call a spade a spade. It's a snooper's charter. It's been finally revealed after months of umming and ahhing by Theresa May, our glorious Home Secretary. And Essentially, this outlines what the security services can do and can't do to spy on people electronically. And it turns out there's an awful lot they can do and very little they can't do. And I've sort of been going through this sort of in detail. I've actually read the bill. And I have to say, my overwhelming sort of feeling having read it is I've got a huge amount of respect for whoever wrote it, because it's actually a work of Machiavellian genius. Because it basically says nothing. It implies they can do very little, but it actually allows them to do an awful lot. If you wanted to sort of surreptitiously sneak in powers, they've done a fantastic job of doing it. It's all smoke and mirrors. And they don't really say anything technical about what's going on. And it's all based on sort of subtle hints. And a lot of it flows around this phrase that they keep using, what's reasonably practicable. And obviously, anything is reasonably practicable. But anyway, let's sort of go through in a little bit more detail what they're talking about. A lot of it's based on what they call telecommunications service providers, which is pretty much anyone who has anything to do with any communication. So by my interpretation of the bill, this could be your ISP. It could also probably be any Mozilla developer. It could also probably be, or it could certainly be anyone who handled any form of messaging client, whether or not they're actually the person hosting the service or just some random developer putting a bit of code together. And it puts this, it also sets up the system of warrants whereby the Home Secretary can apply for a warrant to spy on people or persons for all sorts of reasons, including testing out their ability to spy on people. So they can just turn around and say, here's a warrant to spy on everyone. We're just going to use it to test out a systems officer and create this warrant. Supposedly, there's some form of judicial oversight in this. So if you read the sort of accompanying text that comes with the bill, it talks about how they have to get a judge's permission to apply for these warrants. However, that's slightly misleading. What they actually do is get to a point, the government gets to appoint somebody who has to sign off on this warrant, who they sort of imply would probably be a judge, but actually can be whoever they want it to be. So they get to appoint the person who oversights them, which might be considered the conflict of interest there. And then they apply this warrant to this telecommunication service provider, and they have to take whatever steps are reasonably practicable to fulfill this warrant. And this is obviously where it says everything can nothing. Is a ban on end-to-end encryption everything reasonable practicable? From a technological perspective, it's incredibly practical. You know, the infrastructure is there. You just got to change a bit of code and you've just banned your end-to-end encryption. But it doesn't explicitly state it. So it's almost impossible to argue against, because they're not actually stating what technical powers they're getting. It all goes into this phrase, reasonably practical. Practicable, which also makes you sound stupid when you say it.
So why not just say... Why have they elaborated on, we're here to help you, and if you've done nothing wrong, you've nothing to fear? Why put it into such kind of verbosity?
Well, I think it's... Before, they didn't really have the power to go to any company...
In fact, they were breaking the law as well in a lot of what they were doing.
Yeah. And to be honest, they're sort of... What they come out and say is that they're putting it into... explicit law exactly what the security services can do. And in a sense, that's certainly a good thing. At the moment, it's a completely mess of laws in the UK, what they can do, and it's not really clear what's legal. They have gotten hot water for illegally monitoring stuff, and they don't really have any legal leg to stand on in the UK, at least, when they're pushing companies to change their encryption techniques. What I particularly like from a Machiavellian point of view about this law is it's not a blanket thing. They're not saying we're banning end-to-end encryption, at which point people like WhatsApp or Apple would turn around and say, no, we're not going to deal with that. And they could put a huge amount of pushback on this law to stop it coming through. What they're instead doing is tying it to a specific warrant, so they can pick their battles once it comes through. If they want, say, some small company to hand over all their user data to remove their end-to-end encryption, they can do it without taking on Apple. at the same time, they can pick the moment at which they push a large company that currently has end-to-end encryption, your WhatsApps, to do it. So when WhatsApp maybe are in trouble, I don't know. Well, they're owned by Facebook, which don't have a great reputation for paying tax in the UK. So at the same time the tax bill and possibly more tax enforcement powers come up, the warrant could turn up at the same time. They can pick the exact moment they wish to apply pressure using this law. So it gives them a huge scope of power just to subtly work the politics of the spying.
Do you think this will help them catch the bad people?
No, because, well, they might be able to put pressure on people, WhatsApp, for example. But if they put the warrant to the people developing, what's it called, electronic caliphate, the encrypted method used by the baddies, then, of course, they're not going to follow the warrant. At the end, they've only got any power to do this to anyone they can arrest, basically. So if you're not in the UK, you can just ignore them.
And that's what I find so deeply troubling about all of this, is that it's good to have an open discussion. It's good that the government wants to do something and wants to make legislation to enshrine their powers to be able to take positive action. But what they have never being able to explain is how these powers correlate to catching the bad people.
No, and there is no answer. It's been constantly shown this doesn't help. It's not because.
And so even though it's the wrong time to be cynical about these kind of proposals, it just can't help asking why. There's no oversight. There seems to be very, very little oversight. There's an awful lot of secret warrants that can't even be revealed, super injunctions against super injunctions. So an ISP can't even say if it's got a warrant against it to do something. And no oversight, no reason that we can see for it working. And okay, as we said so many times now in this debate, fair enough now, but these powers will be misused. I'm certain of it.
Yeah, and it's the scope of it. It's if you needed to target, if you say, okay, this guy is up to no good, then there exist many, many techniques for extracting information that you need without completely destroying the security of everybody in the country.
Yeah. And I think, privacy is an important thing and it's worth fighting for. I think it's a privacy as part of civilization. I'm not talking about outright privacy. I'm talking about the right to expect privacy and for it to be defended on your behalf.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at sort of countless examples throughout history where people needed their privacy to drive society on. I mean, there's the classic ones of people like Nelson Mandela fighting in South Africa and similar cases in the UK back in the day. Would the Magna Carta ever have come to exist if the king had to know what the nobles were talking about all the time?
And I guess bringing it back round to Linux and open source is that in some ways, open source is opposed to a lot of this possible legislation because it's going to be impossible for certain kind of warrants to be executed on pieces of open source software, open source communication software, for
example. Yeah, I mean, it's not... it's, again, what could come into reasonably practicable. They could, theoretically, I'm pretty sure, under this bill, they could force, say, an encryption developer to put a backdoor into a piece of open source encryption, but what does that mean? Does it mean that if he was the maintainer, he'd have to accept a pull request from GCHQ? Does it mean that he would have to put in a pull request that may or may not get accepted?
What would Linus do?
I mean, are we really saying, and if that is the case, you could really make the case that no open source security software can be maintained from the UK anymore.
Yeah, or is practicable.
Yeah. And this, as I say, I've got a huge respect for the way they've managed to get so much into this bill with really giving away very little. And it's so easy to defend. Oh, it's just what's reasonably practicable. Oh, of course we're not going to do any of that. It's just what's reasonably practicable. But actually, when that comes down to the interpretation, it's really focused on the practicality. And a lot of these things are incredibly easy to do. That doesn't mean they should be done.
I could talk about it for a lot longer, like we did at the live Og Camp thing, but we should probably move on.
Should we move on to something a little bit happier?
Yes, please.
Cheer our little spirits up. Yes. The first Linux-based Steam or games consoles have gone on sale.
Oh, yeah.
The Steam boxes. So you can now, I don't know if you can buy them in shops anywhere, but you can certainly go online and buy a Linux games console. And they start from around $500. So what's that, about 350 quid?
Yeah.
Okay. The ones on sale at the moment are from Alienware, Zotac, and Cyber, maybe? I don't know.
Don't know, sorry.
So, yeah, there's three companies releasing them at the moment, and we're likely to see more in the coming weeks and months. Yeah, they're from around $500 up to quite a lot of money if you really want to pick out the best options, because unlike all of the games consoles, these are sort of customizable. You can put in and take out bits, whatever you want. There's, according to the Steam website, there's over 1,000 games available, but a lot of people are counting it at around 1,500.
So what sort of standardizes these? I guess the fact that they all run SteamOS, and do they all come with the same Steam controllers?
Yeah, so they should all come with a Steam... I don't think they do, actually.
I think there's a bundle with a Steam controller. Some of them still come with an Xbox 360 controller. You have a choice. Yeah, so it isn't actually part of the SteamOS standard.
I thought it was. So, yeah, you can also buy the controller separately, and the controller is specifically designed to make PC games work on a console. So it's got these, it's a little bit hard to describe. It's got these two sort of touchpad things for your thumbs that are sort of circular, and it looks like a controller with two touchpads for your thumbs.
Yeah.
If you go online, you'll see loads of videos of them. I haven't had the chance to use one myself, but I do hear they work quite well.
I played on one at Oddcamp. I think it was on the intro-ware stand. Yeah. And, okay, so I've not spent any time with it. I think the design, I play quite a few games on my PlayStation, so I'm very used to the dual analog joystick. And while I have played FPSs on PCs, mostly when we used to work with Paul Hudson and he'd insist on playing Unreal, I think the touchpads are there mostly to try and bridge the gap between analog sticks and mouse control, which, you know, devotees of first person shooters rely upon. And from what I've read, it is possible to get more sensitive, finer granularity to your control than a joystick. And one of the best things about Steam OS and the front end that Valve has created is that I think every game is reconfigurable in how, especially with the Steam controller, into the scaling and the amount of force that's given. And there's also force feedback in the controller, which is really subtle and really nice and really ties into how you're moving. Like when you move your fingers across the letters of the on-screen keyboard, it actually feels like you're rolling your thumb over bumps on the touchpad. And that's a really nice kind of immersion factor. So it's a really nice thing to have. Probably I'd still have a 360 controller or a PlayStation controller alongside it because I'm just so used to it. But maybe for games like Portal, which I think comes bundled with the controller if you buy it now, Portal 2, which is a wonderful game, you know, it's better than using a joystick because it's more like a mouse.
Yeah, it's one of these sort of bits of news that's been delayed. You know, we've been expecting it for a long time, but it still feels really cool that you can go out and buy what is essentially a Linux PC from.
Yeah, you know, I know,
all these companies
and all of these big titles. No Fallout 4, but lots of other big titles coming to Linux. It's very good.
Yeah. Let's move back into desktop Linux news. Debian Live is no more. If you wish to be ironic, you would say it was dead.
like rain on your wedding day all over again.
The announcement was made by Daniel Bauman, the lead developer, and he described it as being hijacked by the Debian CD and Debian installer teams. And he linked in his announcement to this bug report by, I forget who it was by, but it's, so you sort of go down the the bug report, and he makes this comment that, oh, you know, you're introducing this package which is invading the Debian Live namespace, and that's going to cause issues for us. Can you just sort of rename it sort of to work with the particular area you're working on? And the response to this is, oh, by the way, we're taking over Debian Live, and it's now becoming part of Debian CD, who are creating this live installer. And he's like, oh, that's an interesting way of letting me know after 10 years working on this project. And the reasons for this sort of switch are reasonably well-intentioned. There's some outstanding bugs with Debian Live, and it doesn't work with UEFI and this sort of thing. But it's just this, I don't know, it sort of delves into the politics of Debian, which can at times not be particularly pleasant. And yeah. So they will still be able to get live versions of Debian, but they'll be built by Debian CD. Yeah, for users, this is a relatively small matter, I guess. But it's...
Yeah. It's probably another example of, I don't know, lack of empathy in the way that developers go about. It's probably, I don't know anything about the story, but they probably just didn't even think about the fact that someone has put 10 years into something. They may feel slight emotional attachment to their project.
Yeah. Right. Next up, the penultimate item on our list of news this fortnight. It's Linus has come under fire for the security policy in the kernel. It's all got kicked off by an article in the Washington Post. What they've got to do with their kernel security, I don't know. But they decided to get involved in it. And they accused him of not taking security seriously enough, to which Linus has responded that he does take security seriously. Security bugs are serious, but he says they're no more serious than any other bugs. All bugs have to be fixed, whether they're security-related or not. And security features, like all other features, have to be weighed up. Look at the pros and cons and decide whether or not to incorporate them into the kernel. Essentially, his policy of security in the kernel comes down to it's reactive. If the security bugs come up, they get fixed. There's relatively little proactive security in the kernel, in that there's not that much to mitigate problems when they happen.
Yeah, in comparison to, say, OpenBSD, where those guys work flat out to absolutely cram mitigations into their code, into their kernel, which can break things. It can actually break end user software in that case. But yeah, it's a very different sort of approach. And I think Linus is going for the more pragmatical one.
Yeah. So in sort of software terms, this is a little bit like SE Linux not being included. SE Linux is a sort of layer that sits there and doesn't really do anything unless there's a security problem. If someone manages to break the security or find an exploit in a particular application, SE Linux then limits what they can do. The sort of equivalent isn't really there in the kernel. If there's a bug, it's pretty much game over. And obviously it can take time to roll out fixes and all that sort of thing. So it doesn't have this thing that prevents bugs from being dangerous if they can be exploited. And there is there's a patch set, the GR Security patch set, which introduces a lot of these sort of things, but it's not included in the upstream kernel. And it's sort of, for various political and tension reasons, it's not been accepted by upstream.
That Washington Post article was very, very good, I thought. I mean, I started reading it thinking that it was... the people that they was roll out whenever a security breach happens is always somebody like Mr. Kaspersky or somebody who owns a virus checking company will say, oh, this is bad, viruses are bad, you really need to protect yourselves against viruses. And I sort of got halfway through thinking that it was just more of the same. But then there's some comments in there by Matthew Garrett, who also wrote on his blog about the same thing. So actually, I had to revisit it and go over and reread what I just read, but taking it more seriously this time.
Mm. Yeah, it did seem a strange choice of article for the Washington Post, but...
Well, it's big business, it's big money, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's massively important.
Yeah, I can see Linus's approach to this, but I'm not sure I agree with him. I think, security does need to be taken a little bit more seriously these days, especially the size of Linux. It's phenomenal.
It's probably
how many things it's in.
It's probably something as simple as like he just doesn't find it exciting, so he just can't be bothered. And he's like, you know, he's so utilitarian when it comes to this kind of stuff. It's like, well, if somebody thinks it's important enough or the OpenBSD project does a better job, then, you know, they can take over responsibility for being the security kernel.
I think it's more that he doesn't see mitigations as important. He sees, you know, because obviously they take security bugs seriously and they do fix them and they, that process does work well. But it's this sort of...
Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit... He's a bit outdated in his view on security now. That perhaps he's been, his view on OS development is stuck a few years ago.
Yeah.
And
I think and you're right. Yeah. I mean, security should have somebody perhaps responsible separate to Linus and Greg Crowe-Hartman and all the rest of it, directly responsible for making sure this mitigation is part of the kernel.
Yeah, because you can argue it two ways, because he could perhaps turn around and say, you know, if you are in a high security environment, use a different kernel. That's not our optimization.
Yeah.
And he might have a point on that. Maybe it is the fault of people putting Linux into high security environments. But at the same time, you could really argue what's not a high security environment these days. I mean, most phones are linked to bank accounts. You know, that's pretty high security. But
yeah, yeah.
Is that... sticking with bugs to our last item of news, there's a bug hunting session for LibreOffice on the 4th to 6th of December. If you want to get involved in open source development, this is a really good chance to do it. There's lots of people sort of available to help new bug hunters and sort of show you the ropes, as it were. So
this is for the upcoming LibreOffice 5.1 release, isn't it?
Yes.
I believe, yeah. Which looks like it's going to be pretty major. They've already talked about halving the time it takes to start the application, which is an impressive feat, if true.
Well, impressive in one way, but why is it taking until 5.1?
I think because it is a vast, vast source code base.
They've just found another 10 million German comments.
Is this just because they've got a faster machine than they did for the 5.0 release? Collab War is doing a bit better and Michael Meeks bought himself a new laptop. We've got GovOffice in the government place now. We can buy some new hardware.
They're just.
It is a great chance to get involved if you're not already. Go to their website to find out more. And that's the news.
Excellent. Thanks, Ben. So it's now time for Finds of the Fortnight, a section which I failed at last time we recorded at Old Camp. I didn't even have a single find. I have asked the IRC channel, and it was.
Is that code for you don't have a find this time I do, as well?
I do actually have a couple of finds. They're audio related, so I'll hold back on it. You know, just to build.
Strap yourselves in, everybody.
Build the anticipation. So I asked the IRC.
Is it a new USB cable?
The IRC channel, I asked, and then it was quiet for like 10 minutes. We were like halfway through news. And then there's been a flood of activity. Enom says, perhaps one thing, last podcast there was a discussion about random data on USB sticks. I remember that was funny. And someone mentioned that there was no way of telling if it's random data or not. Well, Enom says there is. It's called entropy analysis. You can use it to extract encryption keys that are placed in a load of pseudo random data, for example.
You can use that to pull out non-random data from random data, but as far as I'm aware, good encryption algorithm should be indistinguishable from random data, even from an entropy analysis point of view.
Yeah, and
you can find stuff hidden in random data, but not encrypted data itself.
And I guess that's the point, isn't it? That's the point of how the quality of the random data itself and the quality of the encryption algorithm. And they're like, you know, like two different currents in the sea. Devilment, could be a find that most people are aware of, but looping your earbud wires over your ear stops the rubbing sound from being transmitted. And then Enon picks it up. The other thing is that on GNOME, if you hold down Shift, I think, and print screen, then you can select an area to copy, not just the whole thing. That's good. I've actually got, there's on KDE, I use Case Snapshot all the time, which is the print screen function. And there's a command line argument for doing a section of the screen that you can bind to the same key. And then this is a good one, Twisted Lucidity. Make MKV, sounds like a command. I've not used it, but he said it rocks. That's my find. The GNU Linux version may still be proprietary, but it works. Take that evil DRM and stop them watching what I just bought. So I'm guessing make MKV is a command that does what it says it does. You stick in a DVD or something, type make MKV, and you get an MKV video file for playback in VLC or something. They have a discussion about KDE then. Twisted Lucidity, another find. The rear USB and Ethernet port on a ThinkPad are separate daughter boards. So when you drop your laptop and destroy the said port, along with the USB cable that was plugged in, it's easier to repair. Bit of a discussion about ThinkPads. Is there something else I can get to? There's somebody new. Bergmeer says, a find that might be useful is using Control-R at the start of a command and then typing the command with Control-R with autocomplete based on the history. This is cumbersome, he says. So I bind, I'll put it in the notes, but it's /E square brackets A double quotes colon history search backwards to a key bind on the up arrow. Oh, right. Okay. In bash RC. So he just uses up arrow and down arrow to do the same thing with the commands. And he's got another binding as well. That sounds good. NetBSC now runs on the Cyan 5MX. I think he says that was in the latest Linux Voice.
I think I covered that in DistroHopper. We have a little BSD section, and I've got an old Cyan somewhere. I think it's a Cyan Sienna. I'm sure there's somebody working at porting NetBSD to that.
Was it deliberately ported to that device, or was it ported to a particular chip and they just happened to get that device in by?
I think it needed to be ported to that device. It has its... I'm not sure what chip is inside it. I think it may be an ARM. But these things take quite a bit of work. But apparently NetBSD is a very good starting point for, you know, if you've got some random-ass piece of equipment, then NetBSD's sort of ultra-portable code and organization makes it quite easy because it's already been ported to similar little handheld computers.
And they're the finds from IRC, so a really good selection. Anyone else want to have a go?
We should probably mention, actually, that this is the #LinuxVoice IRC channel on Freenode, chat.freenode.net. Yeah. So, yeah, anyone's welcome to join in, log on with XChat or WeChat or whatever all the cool kids are using these days. I've just got a quick find, which I'll mention. DockerCraft. This is a Minecraft client for Docker. Basically,
hang on, what?
DockerCraft. You connect using all sorts of magic, you connect Minecraft up to Docker and you can see your Docker containers as actual little buildings in the Minecraft world. And then you climb inside them and they've got little levers to start and stop them. It's charmingly pointless. I have no idea why it exists, but half of the most awesome stuff in free software could be argued as being pointless. It's just...
I can see it working in like Hollywood movies, you know, like in Die Hard 5 and they need to hack something. You know, I know this. This is DockerCraft. Let me spin up some new instances and bring up some more servers.
Is there an Oculus Rift version of Minecraft?
Well, there must be. Must be a mod.
That would be something. This reminds me of you guys probably heard of it. Many years ago, there was a version of Doom where the enemies had process IDs above their heads, and whenever you killed the enemies, that process would get a kill 9 signal from
the operating system. No, I didn't know. That's really good.
Yeah, so if I you accidentally that. Shot like a cyber demon that was... has been in it, then your system's going down.
Just so like you're in a real battle, though, yeah.
Yeah, that's my solitary find.
All of us were actually sent a find because it was sent to info@linuxvoice.com. I think I might have forwarded it, but maybe not. Ahoy, Linux Voice team. This is from Simon Hornbachner. First of all, I sent him a load of magazines. Second, after Ben's rant about Firefox not being a usable browser anymore, I'd like to suggest to him to take a look at Pale Moon. Pale Moon is a fork of Firefox with carefully selected features and optimizations to maximize the browser speed, stability, and user experience. I think we've mentioned Pale Moon before, and
a couple of people have suggested Pale Moon to me. I have to say, actually, after all that talk about leaving Firefox, I've actually gone back. I just couldn't do it. Every morning, I sort of hover over the Chrome, and I'm like, I can't do it. And I go back to Firefox. And every once in a while, I get annoyed with Firefox and switch to Chrome for the afternoon. But for the most part, I'm still using Firefox. But I will check out Pale Moon. It does sound quite interesting.
So I've got a couple of... they've kind of... Well, firstly, and the Black Phone 2, this isn't really a find. This is kind of a request for information. Black Phone 2 has been released in the UK. I haven't got one, haven't tried one. But it's a very interesting project, I think. It's expensive. It's like 650 quid, and it's a hardened version of Android running kind of Whisper systems and stuff like that. But what I found interesting, and I don't know enough about it, is that the version of Android that they ship basically containerizes different spaces for doing different things on your phone, which I think is a really good idea. So, for example, the different pages on your phone aren't just pages for organizing your apps. They're different containers for running those apps in. So you could put Facebook and eBay and Amazon in one and put your phone and text messaging and other things in another. And there is no way for the data from one container to make it into another container.
That's fantastic.
That's the same way CubesOS works on the desktop.
Exactly, and I was going to say exactly the same thing. And I think this is such a good idea. I wanted to know, I couldn't find whether there was the source for this so that it could perhaps be built on phones that support CyanogenMod, which I'm assuming is what it's based upon. And also, I really like the idea, and this is kind of from my own head, that you can put in a different passcode and go into a different... container from the unlock, you know, so that even if somebody gets your phone or copies your swipe code, or if you have to hand it over at immigration or something like that, you know, you could give them one swipe code and it decrypts a certain container, and your other private ones or whatever your other forms of communication can be kept completely isolated. And I think this is getting back to talking about privacy from OldCamp. This is like an implementation like I can see as being simple and easy to understand and yet very powerful in its implementation and what it's able to offer.
Yeah, I mean, from a technical perspective, I'm not sure container security is quite up there yet enough to guarantee the security in the same way that virtual machine security is. Well, it's not perfect, but it's certainly better than containers. But yeah, it's certainly a good approach. And if you haven't seen CubesOS on the desktop, it works using the Xen virtual machine manager, allows you to do a very similar thing. So sort of have a trusted virtual machine, a untrusted virtual machine, I don't know, a banking virtual machine, whatever you want, and shuffle data around them. And it makes it all quite easy to use. It's not, you know, it's obviously a performance hit, and but it's not that significant on a modern machine. The memory usage is significantly higher, but not ridiculously so.
I saw Cubes mentioned by Edward Snowden just this week in an interview he did, along with Tails, in terms of some journalists asking what he'd recommend to use for added security and privacy.
The only slightly annoying thing with Cubes is you can't run it itself in a virtual machine, so you can't try it out without... I'm not even sure if there's a live version. You might have to actually install it.
Right.
Which is kind of understandable given the technology involved.
Yeah, yeah. And so my other find, a little bit lighter, is really from writing the last couple of FOSPICs, or the FOSPICs from a couple of months ago. There was a synthesizer that I really have to highlight as being like the best open source synthesizer I've used, and it's called Helm. And it's just beautifully designed, and the sound of it is it's just a classic analog synth. And really, that's all there is to say. You have to install it and try it out. It comes with loads of presets. The user interface is beautiful. It's scalable. It updates with nice little pretty waveforms and blinking lights, which I think is the only reason why anybody uses a synthesizer. And then just last month, I found another one. So it's like a renaissance of synthesizers for open source software, and it's called OXE. And that's a synth. So Helm does like classic subtractive synth sounds like you get on old synthesizers. And Ox is an FM synthesizer like the DX7 and like the little chips on Sound Blaster cards. It loads DX7 presets. So they're both totally different in timbre, in their capabilities and in their synthesis engines. But both of them create wonderful sounds and really the kind of stuff that you would pay a few hundred pounds for 5 or 6 years ago in terms of commercial software synthesizers. And it's great, like Linux and gaming, to see audio really seems to be picking up on Linux. And so we recorded last the live episode of our podcast last time on Linux on Ardour. It was a high pressure situation because we're in front of the audience and set up in front of the audience, and Linux and Ardour and Jack, along with the M Audio audio interface, just worked perfectly. It's great. They're my finds. Does anyone else want to have a go?
Aye.
Lack of leadership here. I know. I'm sorry. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. My discovery is Code Club. Because I've been going to Code Club at school. It's weird being in a school, it really is.
Do they have really little chairs?
They have normal-sized chairs, but they have posters on the wall with like vague sort of public sector-style slogans like Inspire, Achieve, and stuff, you know, stuff that just doesn't mean anything. It's great.
Oh, you've just reminded me of school. In particular, there's like one classroom that had a bit of graffiti that stayed there for all of the time I was at school, and the graffiti just said, wow. I can just remember geography lessons of hours of them and just staring at it and going, wow, wow.
Are you sure it was graffiti? The teacher hadn't put it out there as like an inspirational message. Right,
yeah. To keep himself sane.
Wow. Sorry, Andrew.
No, that's quite all right. So the first lesson was... Sorry, the teaching is being provided by a couple of chaps from York Council, web developers there, and they're brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant. The first lesson was based on Scratch, and it was on a lesson provided by Code Club. And that was full of... That was just really hard to follow, because it assumed knowledge that I didn't have. So first of all, it's how to navigate your way around a Microsoft interface. So like just stuff like going to the start menu and things like that. I've just never done that. I don't know. You know, I keep trying to minimize Windows and then closing the application and trying to getting it to having to relaunch things again. And the stuff like, oh, look in the sprites list. And at the time, you've only got one item in the sprites list. So it doesn't look like a list, because a list is several things, you know, in a line. So I was just like tearing my hair out of this. But then we moved on to C sharp, which is what the chaps use day in, day out. And they're just so good at explaining how stuff works. You know, I must have looked at how to do lists and variables and you know, declare a variable and like so. But because they're not dumbed it down, they're very aware that they're talking to non-codery people. So they're using very simple language to explain some quite complicated things, and that's very hard to do. They're doing a superb job. So yeah, Visual Studio for me all the way now. I'm gonna get on the old .NET C sharp bandwagon.
Good career choice, I think.
Yeah, and just wave you luck goodbye. But the great thing is that I can see how we did Hello World in lesson two, and the woman next to me said, "Yeah, but what have we done? and I agree with that. I think Hello World is a very poor example as to show somebody how to get into coding, because it's pointless. You've not achieved anything. You can't see that and then use your imagination to say, oh wow, I can use that to put a weather station on the roof of my shed. It's just nonsense. You know, as an exercise in how an exercise for people who are already programmers, it makes sense, but it doesn't make sense for an absolute beginner. But we've now moved on to things that are really cool.
I mean, I think Hello World originates in the days when getting a computer to do anything at all was quite a difficult task. So the very ability to get words appearing on a screen was considered an achievement in itself.
Yeah, you're right. I can remember like Lattice C on the Amiga, and the challenge was actually building the tool chain and making sure that you could make and link and get the actual thing to work. The code part was the least of your worries.
Right, but what is it in Python? Yeah. Is it just print Hello World?
Yeah.
But it's like that has stayed with us, the whole Hello World thing, at a time when now you just have to, yeah, it's a single line. I completely agree with you about it.
It's an interesting what you said about Scratch, because visual programming languages like that are a sort of double-edged sword in that it is quite hard to explain stuff about them, because it is sort of click here, do that, do that, rather than, you know, it's much easier to explain a typed language. You type this word means this word means that. And that doesn't change, whereas interfaces often switch between modes and things pop up and disappear. And if you've done something wrong, it may not appear, but you can't work out why it's not there. And it sort of, it can, but once you get your head around them, you don't need to remember syntax, and you have nice, big, colourful things that slot into the right places. And if it slots, it's right. If it doesn't slot in, it's the wrong thing. And that can help, but... I've never quite been sure what to make of Scratch, whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing.
I can see how it would be useful if it's taught properly, but if you're just there dragging and dropping things because they fit without really any understanding of what you're doing, then I can't really see how much it would help. My other discovery based on this is that Microsoft's word for tab completion is IntelliSense. It's really tickled me. you get halfway through typing something, and then you'll see it come up, and you can press tab, and that's IntelliSense. It's amazing. IntelliSense.
Oh dear, that's a horrific word.
Isn't that awful?
Especially when the alternative is tab completion.
Cool, thanks, Andrew.
I've got a couple of finds. My first is, one thing that's always annoyed me about the English language is that there's no word for the at symbol. So when you're reading anything else with the at symbol, it's sort of really awkward, because you never know if at is a word in the thing you're saying or if it's a symbol. In Finnish, they call it a snail.
Well, doesn't that have the same problem? You don't know if they mean the word snail or the symbol.
Yeah.
Maybe.
GrahamSnailLinuxVoice.com.
Yeah, BenSnailLinuxVoice.com.
In Russian,
I'm going to start saying that now.
In Russian, it's a dog.
Is it?
I think.
Because it looks like a curled up dog.
Probably. I think it's a dog.
What was it? Did you say Finnish or Swedish? I was just...
Finnish.
I was just wondering, what is Finnish for snail?
I can't
remember. Maybe we should just say that. That makes more sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is actually a completely stolen from one of my finds last podcast, which is no such thing as a fish.
You've undermined yourself now. You have no authority here.
Oh, but my next find is entirely mine.
How do we know? Say it? We can't trust you. Oh.
If it's geeky, then it is Ben's.
I was calling an at symbol a snail, not geeky. So I've been using a standing desk for the past, I don't know, fortnight, 3 weeks, maybe a month by now. When I say standing desk, I actually mean set of shelves with a computer on them. But the principle's the same. I'm standing up to do my work. And I've actually really enjoyed it. It's really, I find it makes it much, much easier to focus on what I'm doing, because I'm sort of standing there, I'm focused on the thing. When I'm sit down, I have this sort of tendency to lean back and get distracted and, I don't know, do other things. When I'm standing up, I'm slightly more alert, more energetic, I'm focused, I'm more comfortable. It's amazing the difference it's made.
This reminds me, when I started learning German 5 years ago, I watched some videos from people fluent in many languages on YouTube. One guy said, always learn standing up. Walk around in your room whilst repeating conversations from your language books. And I did that. So I probably sounded like a complete nutter to the people who live below me, walking around speaking bad German. But I think the principle's the same. If you're lying down on the couch, your body's in this sort of resting state, not particularly alert. If you're standing up, you're paying more attention, you're things are soaking into your brain better.
Yeah. Initially, I thought, because I know a lot of people sort of split standing and sitting, and you can do that on my setup quite easily. And I thought, you know, I've probably sort of gradually build up to standing a bit more and more. But actually, I didn't at all. From day three, I think I've just stood up. I'm sitting down now because I need to sit down to record. But other than that, I stand up all day, every day.
Well, like 8 hours or so.
Probably more than 8 hours most days. Yeah.
I should try it. I'm just so lazy.
Yeah. That's the thing. It stops you being lazy.
Yeah. It might help.
It really has made a huge difference, as you may have noticed, to my productivity.
We should do a challenge. I'll just challenge myself for next time and report back on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is important to be able to adjust the height of what you got your stuff at. I say it's a set of shelves, and it is, but it's an adjustable set of shelves. So I've got it to the right, the height, everything's sort of nice and secure in there. It's not sort of just lashed together with gaffer tape. And it's also, everyone says you need a mat to stand on. And I thought, this sounds a bit weird. You need a mat to stand on? Yeah. I don't stand on a mat usually. But actually, I'm actually using two pieces of carpet folded in half. But just that little thing, because it does put quite a lot of strain on your feet. And that's probably the bit that I've had the most issues with over the last couple of weeks. But they're all right now. And yeah, it's extra. I don't know if I work from home. And if I was working from the office, I'd probably wear my shoes.
Like a fetish to me.
How is it?
I don't know. Is it tiger skin, the carpet on the floor, or is it?
Obviously not. It's a leopard. He stands on a tiger.
Vladimir Putin
on the back of an elephant.
A tiger on an elephant.
Putin is
my enemies will tremble before me.
Putin is Discworld.
So anyway, yeah, I'd recommend having something to stand on just to ease the pressure on your feet. But other than that, it works well.
Excellent. Thank you, everyone. That was a brilliant find section.
So, bloated and bilious, we waddle towards the halfway reminder. Still to come, there's an Og box, there's Voice of the Masses, and there's that other thing.
No.
No, there isn't.
There's the end.
That's it.
There's the end.
There's the end.
There's the light,
the light at the end of the tunnel.
So Andrew sounds like he's wiltering there, but I'll jump in and say, we had an Og box sent to us. We also had some neurons, but we don't really have time to read them all out this episode. I'll postpone them to next episode. But Mr. MJB sent in this recording, so let's hear it.
Hi, Linux Voice crew. It's Mr. MJB here with some reflections on your magazine. As a non-tinkerer, hobbyist, coder, or power user, I'm probably far from your target audience, but I remember when Graham left his previous job, I looked him up on G+, and sent him a message that if he ever got round to kickstarting his own magazine, I'd be the first to back it. And when it did launch, I'd pitched in within the first hour or two. I really believe the work you do around freedom, privacy, and openness to be of tremendous importance. I think it's going to be very easy as a society to embrace top-down control, simply because we prefer convenience over freedom. The example I always think of is SatNav. Once every driver is using Google Maps for every journey, it will be able to send drivers around different routes to ensure that all roads are used equally, none unused, and none overused to the point of causing traffic black spots. Our commuting lives will be much improved, but a freedom as basic as being able to choose the route we drive along will have been lost. Whether such a situation should be allowed or not, I don't know, but we certainly need educating about how and why such a thing might happen, so that, if it does, we will have consciously chosen it, rather than unconsciously, because we didn't know there was even a decision to be made. I do have one small criticism of the magazine, which is that the proofing is sometimes leaving a little to be desired. I'd like to suggest opening your proofing to the community. Each issue, you could put out a call for anyone willing to proof and send each person one article to proof and return. Finally, I'd like to mention one of my favourite things about your magazine, which is Simon Phipps. I always find his column insightful and enlightening. I'm writing this shortly after a weekend of atrocious acts of terrorism around the world, and so I'll read some sentences from his issue 12 column, which I think are some of the best written on the subject. We should respond to this act of hate, which is as indefensible to anyone who embraces one of the world's religions as to those who reject them all, by ensuring we do not succumb to the self-destructive reactions perpetrators of terrorism want to provoke. I refuse to be terrorized and decline the opportunity to hate.
So thanks, Mr. MJB. Of course, that Simon Phipps column he's referring to there was from issue 12, as he mentioned. So that was just after the Charlie Hebdo massacre. You know, it was obviously a lot of similarities with what happened last week. If anybody else has an Og box they want to send in, a couple of minutes of their musings, record it and email it to me, mike@linuxvoice.com. And as mentioned, we'll catch up on some neurons in the next episode.
It's a good time to bring it up that it's been 2 years since the Indiegogo campaign was live. No, so we've made it 2 years. Well done, everyone.
That means we've outperformed 80% of business startups. So if we were on The Apprentice, we'd probably get down to like the last four.
That means we've got careers on daytime television ahead of us. and Daily Mail columnists. That's what I've always wanted to be.
I've got a proud boast, which is off topic, which further inflating this already corpulent podcast. It's been a year since I've looked at the Daily Mail online.
Well done.
A year last week. Yeah, thanks everybody. My brain feels much cleaner.
I haven't quite done that, but I have extracted myself from r/WTF, which I'm quite proud of.
Oh, well done.
I feel a lot cleaner for it.
Yeah, that's a weird place.
It's a weird place that leads to even weirder places. That's the problem. It's like it's really going down the rabbit hole.
And speaking of weird places that goes to even weird places, it's time for our Voice of the Masses. This month, this fortnight, somebody has said something and Mike was there to hear it.
Indeed, like almost like a real journalist. I was at the SousaCon conference in Amsterdam a couple of weeks ago, and they Sousa announced the release of their new distro, OpenSousa 42.1 Leap, there. And the chairman of the OpenSousa board said a few interesting things, and he said that he believes rolling releases like Arch or Sousa's own Tumbleweed are the future of Linux distributions, including somewhere quite far down the line, enterprise distros. Which is quite an interesting statement, because we normally think of rolling distros like Arch as being stuff for us geeks and hobbyists, but we know stuff will break or you know things are changing rapidly, whereas big businesses want SUSE Linux Enterprise or Red Hat Enterprise Linux. We thought we'd ask the community about this. And what did they say? Well, we asked, is this true? Do people think this is true? Rolling releases are the future.
I know what I think.
Hey, Luz.
No, of course not. It's nonsense. You look at the rolling releases at the moment. Arch just breaks things. I wouldn't want that anywhere near any serious work.
But that's because Arch makes that decision. It goes. It's not just a rolling release decision. Arch is a particularly volatile rolling release.
Yeah, but as long as Arch is the poster boy for rolling releases, then that would be the perception. So, yes, Brocker says, I can't speak for Enterprises, but my experience with rolling Arch was one of one thing breaking after another.
I feel like we need a self-help group for Arch users. Arch Anonymous.
Isn't Arch users a self-hurt group?
Basically, it wasn't worth it. What I would like to know is if this is an intrinsic feature of rolling or just of a distro with a limited user base. An intrinsic feature of Arch is that it breaks things. Excellent. Richard Brown, who is the SUSE chap, isn't he? Says the big difference between OpenSUSE, Tumbleweed and Arch is that we test each set of updates to our rolling release before releasing them. Does that imply that Arch doesn't do that?
Well, what the OpenSUSE guys have this open QA system, which is quite a funky sort of automated testing thing. Packages can't go out if they don't work. They can't be released. So I think this is what's coming up here. Yeah, if the Arch team are happy to let things break and just say, well, read the news page. You know, that's, you've got to learn to deal with these things yourself. But that doesn't mean that all rolling releases, I think, would be inherently unstable. With containerization of software, better library versioning, automatic QA, I think rolling releases can be a lot more reliable.
I also feel like I should say something in Arch's defense, that it really is stable a lot of the time, and a lot of the problems you bring upon yourself. I've used it for years. I know everyone thinks you're showing off when you say, but I've used it for years. It's still great. I still wouldn't switch to anything else. It's a really enjoyable distro. Would I run it on a server? No way.
The pace of change is just glacial, though. There was some story this week about French air traffic control uses Windows 3.1.
Yeah.
And NASA is looking for Fortran programmers to maintain some code that was written in the 1970s. There's, you know, if NASA can't get its head around rolling releases, then you know who do you expect will? Mm. Some trendy startup maybe that's creating an app that makes you feel like a grown up even though you're actually a child. Yeah. You know, with your idiot box in shortage.
If you look at,
they might use rolling releases.
If you look at the French air traffic control system, that's actually a really good example of why rolling releases would be a good thing for something like that. Because the cost of a major systems upgrade isn't.
It's going to be incredibly huge now, isn't it?
But if they could have just little by little upgraded, and so along the way they would never have needed to do that huge systems upgrade, they would now have. Well, okay, it'd be Windows 10, which would be a bit rubbish. But they would at least have had that sort of gradual, and they'd still have a modern system. But instead of having to suddenly throw out everything and throw in a whole new system.
Yeah. This is what they're talking about, the possibility in the enterprise. You know, we're so used to this do nothing, then huge upgrade every few years, then do nothing, huge upgrade.
Yeah.
If they can be spaced out, and then that's actually more conservative in a way, even though it sounds like a bit of a contradiction.
Mm. Fair enough. Lucifer, getting back to the question of are rolling releases the future, says, if they are like Arch Linux, I don't think so. I'm sick of removing a bloody soft link to get an update to work. Every single new version of systemd means potential problems. Everything is fixable, of course, but I would love something that just works.
Is this from the Reddit thread, or is this from the lovely Linux voice thread?
This is from the lovely Linux voice thread.
Oh, no.
I know. Yeah. Hate for Arch. Victor Engmark says, I've been using Arch for a few years now, and it's hands down the most stable distro I've ever used. Wow. Yeah, compared to Ubuntu, where the machine was unbootable after almost every point upgrade. That's far from from my experience, but that's...
Actually, that did happen to me last week on Ubuntu. I did an apt-get upgrade, and it wouldn't... Well, no, it would boot, but it booted to a blue screen with nothing else.
You had an actual blue screen of death in Linux.
Yeah, an actual blue screen of death. I still don't know quite what caused it, but I think I managed to knacker up the... Somehow the update managed to knacker up the login manager session, which was set to boot straight into the user, so you couldn't interrupt it and change it. So the only way around it was to install a different login manager, which didn't then have this automatic login setting. So I'm now using Unity with GDM, and that sort of works. But I don't know what caused the problem.
Okay, we've had enough anti-Arch prejudice. Let's get onto some more positive constructions. Jörg Billards says, I really like the running releases, and in my home office, I never had a problem with it. The backup partition with an LTS distro has been unused for 2 years now. Torwag says, there's no reason why it shouldn't work. The sysadmin can make any rolling release distro into a quarterly updated distro. Simply run the package manager only every 4 months or whenever you feel you have time to deal with some after-update problems.
That's fair enough, provided you don't need any software in the interim.
Or any of the...
Well, if you need to install a new bit of software but the rest of your software is out of date, it won't necessarily work.
Right, okay, that makes sense. And then Torwag also says, server versus rolling release debate. Running one server per service, I'm always surprised to see that even after months without updating, all it takes to update a server is often less than a dozen upgradable packages. If you run a server which requires you to update 1,800 packages on a weekly basis, I guess you are doing something wrong. Go check out Docker.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. The less you're running, the less there is to update, and the easier a rolling release is to manage. But the big sort of elephant in the room here is stuff like the systemd upgrades, big things that fundamentally change the way your system works.
I just think there are cases where you won't want a rolling release, like my arcade machine. I've really no intention of ever upgrading it. It does what it does, and I can.
Then does it make any difference whether it's rolling release or not? Then it's just what it was.
Yeah, because if it was a rolling release, I'd have to keep maintaining it. So it's pre-systemd Manjaro on there.
Yeah, but do you ever update it at all?
No.
So it wouldn't matter what it was when you installed it if you never used the package manager.
Or whether it was there's no point for it to be a rolling release distro.
Yeah,
also no point in it not to be.
Are you using it as a server? Does it need security updates?
Yeah, I mean, Andrew, that's right. If I did update it, it would be to update some security in the kernel, and maybe live patching kernels will be the answer, at least for some implementations. And other times it's really annoying. So, for example, Google updated. So I wrote about it in a version and a previous issue of Linux Voice. I've got a script that works out groceries running on Google spreadsheets and Google scripting engine. And Google has updated all of its apps, its spreadsheets and its word processors and its scripting engine. And we have absolutely no choice about it. And its updates broke the scripts. And I had to spend quite a bit of time going back to the script and fixing it. No documentation, no warning. And had I been given the choice, I would have simply left it at the old version. And that's what I see as the danger in rolling releases, is that the control that you have is taken away from you, even though there are advantages in certain ways. Like WordPress, if we were forced to update WordPress, it would actually just add to our workload.
I can think of some organizations who it would be very helpful for them to have been forced to update WordPress.
Yeah.
Back to the masses and their voice. Philip says, I see two major challenges for rolling releases. First, they might have issues with stability, but I'm sure that with enough automated testing and a well-designed release model, a distribution could get a rolling release pretty close to a fixed version distro stability-wise. And OpenSUSE might just be an example of how seldom a rolling release breaks. But here's another thing. I work in an environment where we have millions of lines of code developed and maintained in-house, and any change to any part of our development chain, be it a new GCC, CMake, C++ version, can easily keep us busy for months. We can simply not afford to change the systems we work on more often than every few years, because if we developed on a rolling release, we would probably never create any new stuff and only do maintenance. And then coming back to NASA and French air traffic control. He says, and from my perspective, that's what happens to a lot of enterprises. That's why we still see COBOL mainframes, OS2 systems, and Lisp scripts. And in my opinion, that's why rolling releases will be an incapable strategy for a lot of enterprises.
That's a fair point. And another sort of related issue is about security auditing. A lot of organizations, and particularly public ones, spend a huge amount of money and time checking the security of a particular setup. Any slight changes could potentially affect the security and would need to be re-audited. So rolling releases there could significantly slow things down.
If you want to understand this more thoroughly, then I recommend going to this discussion at linuxvoice.com, Voice of the Masses, Are Rolling Releases the Future of Distros? Because Richard Brown, who is the OpenSUSE, is he the lead developer or lead maintainer?
He's the chairman of the OpenSUSE board. So, okay. Yeah, he's sort of like the boss of OpenSUSE, I guess.
But he's left some comments on there, and he seems to have changed a few people's minds with the way that he's not just, you know, waded into the flame bait and gone, Arch sucks, SUSE is ter best, Zors. Do read what he has to say, because it's too complicated for my tiny mind, which is why I've not read any of his stuff out.
It's a good question, though. It's one of those questions that sounds simple and easy to answer, and then you start thinking about it, and it's quite complex, and also gets to the root of a lot of what we get out of Linux and why we use Linux and open source software.
To be perfectly honest, I don't know my stance on this. I really don't. I don't particularly like rolling releases, but I don't particularly like non-rolling releases either. Both have issues. Neither one. I kind of think that the solution is something that we haven't yet thought of, something that's neither rolling nor not rolling. And I think certainly if you could get better rollback support and better and that sort of thing, then a rolling release would be more attractive. And the ones where you can install multiple versions of libraries and roll forward and backwards very easily might be a better system. Or that just might massively overcomplicate the whole thing as well.
No, that's a very good point, Ben. Yeah, things like Ubuntu Snappy, for instance. I wrote about this a few issues ago, and the idea that you can install an update, and if it doesn't work, you simply put one command and everything goes back to the way it was before. I think that would help to mitigate a lot of the problems in rolling releases. You know, we've all had our arch breakages where we're like, okay, now it's time to fix this. Whereas if we could be like, oh, just, no, that didn't work. Go back. You know, literally just run backwards, then that'd be great.
Yeah, and there's things like, is it NixOS where you can have like several versions installed at once and of each, say, a library, and each individual package can rely on a different one. So even though you can have like the rolling release thing, not everything rolls at the same time. And if that doesn't come back, you can go back with this package, but not with this package. And you can do stuff like that.
Like you say, it's a bit more complicated and it can use more disk space, but maybe this is the answer, that some combination of these things that nobody's really thought of yet.
Disk space is cheap these days.
True. Anyway.
Right, so that is this the end, beautiful friend? The end.
I think I'm still confused by the order after your intro. I've no idea. Is it the halfway reminder now?
It could be the end.
It's been an epic podcast. And also, if this is the end, there is one more thing. So a few episodes ago, I played a piece of music and said this would be nice if people wanted to send us in their CC by SA music and we'll play out the podcast with it. I didn't have any immediate responses, but over the last few weeks, I think it's been four since we did a recording like this, we've had quite a few people send in their music. And so I liked ending on some different music last time, so I thought we'd do the same this time. And so we've had an email from Ben Regier. He says, hello, Graham. I'm a long-time listener of the podcast since far back into the Tux Radar days. At this point, I feel like I know you guys. I've been a musician for many years. And he seems to remember that one of us plays the mandolin. I think that was Andrew.
That's correct.
And he's playing the mandolin, and he's been using Linux since 2006. A few months ago, he started a new project. He uses Ada, Hydrogen and Audacity. It's all based around him playing the mandolin and cutting it up into different places. It sounds really nice. And I'm going to play out with that music and put the link to his SoundCloud tracks in the podcast notes. So
awesome. This is awesome. Good way to end. Yeah.
So thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Ben, Andrew, and Mike. And we'll see you all again in 2 weeks' time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.